Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd suffer the effects of diprosopus if you made me face the idea that you missed today's show. Lean impact. Your organization can adopt the lean innovation practices that helped fuel the rapid evolution of digital tech in Silicon Valley. And Mei Chang says you need to if you're to do your best work in social change. She's author of the new book, Lean Impact. On Tony's Take Two, train. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven and technology-enabled. Tony.ma/Pursuant. By Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. By Telos, turning credit card processing into your passive revenue stream. Tony.ma/TonyTelos. And by Text to Give, mobile donations made easy. Text NPR to 444-999. It's a pleasure to welcome Anne Mei Chang to the show. She's the author of Lean Impact, How to Innovate for Radically Greater Social Good. She's worked as Chief Innovation Officer at USAID and Mercy Corps and served the U.S. Department of State as Senior Advisor for Women and Technology in the Office of Global Women's Issues. Prior to her pivot to the public sector, Anne Mei had more than 20 years' experience as a technology executive at Google, Apple, and Intuit, as well as a range of startups. She's at Anne Mei, and her book is at annemei.com. I'm very glad her book brings her to Nonprofit Radio. Welcome to the show, Anne Mei.
Thank you so much for having me, Tony.
Real pleasure. Oh, you're coming in loud and clear. Your tech is, not surprisingly, your tech is awesome. You sound great.
Thank you.
This lean impact process that you've evolved comes from the lean startup movement. I read his book, but I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Is it Reese? Is it Eric Reese?
Yeah, Eric Reese.
Okay, it's Reese.
Yeah.
So so lean startup came from Toyota manufacturing. Talk a little about some little overview of lean startup and how you've morphed this into the social change work and lean impact.
Yeah, sure. So Eric Reese wrote a book called Lean Startup about 7 years ago now, where he described a methodology for building products and services under conditions of extreme uncertainty. And this is certainly, it's sprung out of his work in Silicon Valley and his own failures and what he learned from those failures about how we build products better. Although it came out of Silicon Valley, it's since then been highly popular and been adopted, in business, both big and small, in government and around the world. It's been a New York Times bestseller that sold over 1 million copies. And this issue of extreme uncertainty is really important. So if you're building a product or service that is well understood and well defined and you know exactly what you need to do, then what you care about is predictable execution. But if you're trying to build something in a realm of high uncertainty, what you need is to figure out how to speed up your process of learning. And that is his core insight, yeah. Is that if we don't know where we're trying to get to, what we need to do is learn as quickly as possible to figure out the best way to get there.
And why should nonprofits care about what came from Lean Startup, which is now your book, Lean Impact?
Yeah, so, the Lean Startup was originally very focused on Silicon Valley, like I said, and it's branched out from there. But if you think about tech startups, they work with high uncertainty because they're trying to build products and services no one has ever done before and not in the same way create new business models, new technologies, and so forth. In the nonprofit world, I would argue that we have at least as much, if not more, uncertainty. We're generally working on challenges that are big, complex, and entrenched that have been around for ages, and where the solutions we have are simply insufficient. Otherwise, we'd all be out of business. Given that we're dealing with this incredible uncertainty, both in not having interventions that are necessarily good enough, as well as not having ones that can scale dramatically enough, that's where techniques such as a lean startup, I think, become really appropriate. And yet, the reality is that innovating in the social sector is much, much harder. And we can talk about all the reasons why. But, you know, from coming from Silicon Valley into the social sector, at first I thought I'd have it easier in some ways. But in fact, it's much, much harder because, you know, we have to deal with things like highly restrictive funding, you know, impact that can be difficult to measure and may take years to realize. And we work with vulnerable populations where the whole notion of experimentation can seem irresponsible.
You, in fact, you lay out some of this. I want to... I ripped out page 63 from your book. I'm not going to ask you to quote page 63. I doubt you have it memorized by page, but because I don't bring books to the studio. But I ripped out page 63, and I'm going to read a paragraph, and I think this sets it up as well as you did, and ask some very important questions that your book and this whole process set out to answer. A grassroots community named Lean Impact sprang up several years ago as an offshoot of the Lean Startup movement, bringing together hundreds of practitioners. What has been missing is a framework that answers the common questions that arise when theory meets reality. How do I experiment when my funding is based on activities and deliverables that are predefined? How can I create a feedback loop when it takes years for true impact to become evident? Is it responsible for us to experiment on people who are already vulnerable? Where do I find the resources to test and iterate when I can barely make payroll? And I thought that was a really striking paragraph and set it up all very nicely and serves as some motivation for people in our nonprofit community to, well, frankly, they got to start with buying the book. I mean, that's the first step. You got to buy the book and then become acquainted with the practice of Lean Impact.
Yeah, and I think in that paragraph, I really just try to call out some of the unique challenges that are faced in the nonprofit sector when we're trying to innovate. It's not that we don't want to innovate. I think that nonprofit leaders very much care about these issues, care about their mission, want to figure out better solutions, but work within constraints that make it very hard to do so. I know many nonprofit leaders that have read the Lean Startup or similar types of books, gone to similar types of training, and go back to their day, you know, their day job, and just feel stuck because these different impediments make it much, much harder to innovate. And so with the Lean Impact book, I'm not trying to come up with some new rocket science way of doing something. You know, most of the techniques I talk about are fairly common sense. But what I do try to do is look at how do we do these common sense things in the context of social good, where we have to work within these kinds of strengths. And I do so by bringing forward the stories of organizations that have been incredibly successful, that have found ways to navigate these and other challenges.
Okay. I agree. You did do that. And we're going to go out just a moment early for our first break. And when we come back, you and I will talk about the way the book is organized around the three hypotheses. First break. Pursuant. They have two resources to help you use data for improved fundraising. The field guide for data-driven fundraising was real-world case studies of organizations using data to hit their fundraising goals, all data-driven, just like Pursuant typically is. And the other is demystifying the donor experience, revealing simple ways to develop relational donor journey for your donors. You find them both at the listener landing page, tony.ma/pursuant, capital P for please. And May, so you have these three hypotheses that the book is built around: inspire, validate, and transform. Can you you sort of set these up for us, and then we'll pedal through, and we'll touch on as much as we can. But you know, we only have an hour. People got to buy the book. I mean, that's all there is to it. So go ahead, yeah, please.
Yeah, so I think you're talking about the three parts of the book.
Yeah,
the book
yeah.
is organized into three parts. The first part is inspire, and I think one of the biggest challenges in the social sector is that we tend to plan within constraints. We look at the amount of the money we have, the amount of staff we have, the size and scope of a grant, and we think, what can we do with what's in front of us with these resources? And so I think the first mindset shift is to think big. You know, I also codified three principles for Lean Startup, the first of which is think big, that we need to start thinking instead of what can we do within the constraints we have, but what is needed in order to move the needle on the problems that we care about. Yeah, and so the first part of the book is really looking at how do we expand our horizons, be more ambitious about what we're trying to do. Then the second part of the book, Validate, is really the core of the book. You know, this is what the Lean Startup is about, is once you, have that, you're thinking big, you have big aspirations, you have a potential solution that might work, how can you validate that solution to determine as quickly, cheaply, as possible whether it does deliver the things that you hope it will? So too often we spend too much time heading down the wrong path and wasting a lot of time and money before realizing some of the mistakes we made. None of us, at least not myself, can design something perfectly for such complex problems that we work on. And so figuring out how we accelerate the pace of learning so that we can validate what, the risks that we are taking on by deploying a new solution is essential to getting to a solution that works. And then the third part of the book is called Transform. And that's really looking at, beyond sort of any individual organization and what they can do to both identify their problems, think big, start small, and experiment. How do we look at the broader system that we work in to transform the system to help us all be more effective? And that includes both with respect to solving problems, the system change that is required. It also pertains to organizations. How do we change the culture of organizations? But it also applies to the sector at large. How do we change the dynamics of funding and the relationship between funders and nonprofits so that we can all achieve more of what we're looking for?
Thank you. Excellent setup. And I see, I understand my mistake. I call these your hypotheses, but the hypotheses are value, growth, and impact. So thank you. Yeah, that's, we'll get to those, but those are the three parts of the book. Those are not three hypotheses. I don't want to confuse people confuse our listeners. You say that, I saw your objective, and this is the last time I'm going to quote the book. Okay. I mean, I don't read books back to authors who have written them, but I just love this too. If you want to find the most efficient path to deliver greatest social benefit at largest possible scale, that seems like, that's what you're trying to help people do through Lean Impact. Most efficient, greatest social benefit at the largest possible scale. Are you still there?
Yeah, you cut out there part way through the quote, so I didn't quite hear the whole quote.
Oh, well, that's a problem. Okay. If you want to find the most efficient path to deliver greatest social benefit at largest possible scale, that seems to me that's what you're trying to get nonprofits to achieve.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that, again, because of a lot of the systemic constraints we work in, a lot of times what we're doing is nibbling away at the edges. We're putting Band-Aids on problems and doing some good and making some difference, which is fantastic. But I think there's a lot more we could do. And the reason that I wrote the book is to look at how can we bring some of these tools that have worked in other domains more squarely into the social sector so that we can deliver greater impact at scale. Because that's ultimately what we're all after. And it's just harder to do. One thing I would sort of add to that is, in the business world, companies are expected to maximize shareholder value or maximize profits. And so everything companies do, all the decisions that they make day to day, the metrics they collect, sort of the incentives they set up are all around how do we maximize shareholder value? How do we maximize profits? And what I'd love to see is in the social sector, whether you're a donor or whether you're a nonprofit or whether you're a social enterprise, that we hold ourselves to that same standard to say we're seeking impact. How do we maximize our impact? Not just how do we have some impact and sort of feel like we've done some good, but how do we maximize that impact? And that's really what the book is about, is trying to put forward some tools that can help us magnify the impact that we're having.
Because the things that we're trying to solve are so grandiose. They're so large. The problems that nonprofits are devoted to are just so enormous.
Yeah, absolutely.
So starting with, inspiration, And listeners have heard many, many guests say the place to start is with your goals. You encourage, you clamor for audacious goals.
Yeah, absolutely. I think nonprofits usually have audacious missions. The thing that I think is often missing, though, is that those missions are aspirational and they're vague. They're, you know, we're going to end poverty. And instead, what I want to encourage us to do is set much more concrete goals that are measurable, that are time-bound, that are geographically bound, so that we know where we're trying to get to more concretely, and have those goals be goals that we don't know how we're going to get to yet. Because if you can achieve your goals with business as usual, there's no reason to take risks or potentially fail and to innovate.
Right.
So set goals that really are a stretch, but that are measurable so that we can tell whether we're making enough progress towards them. And that sets the stage to orient everyone in the organization, as well as the other partners, to knowing exactly what we're trying to get to. If you think of President Kennedy's call to send a man to the moon, that galvanized the nation to try to figure out how are we going to do this thing that we don't yet know how to do. And I think for nonprofits, if we don't set more concrete goals, it's easy to fall into the trap of just moving in the right direction, but not necessarily moving fast enough or deeply enough.
A part of what you point out related to this is a problem that we tend to fall in love with our solutions, and you want us to fall in love with the problems.
Yeah, I love the phrase, fall in love with your problem, not your solution. I think this is a problem also in the business world that organizations can, you know, companies can get very excited about their product or service and you know, get stuck to that and forget about what problem they're trying to solve. But I think it's an even greater challenge in the social sector. I think that there's a tendency to fall in love with our problems even more for a number of reasons. One is that whatever solution we have, it's usually doing some good. It's rare that we don't have a solution that's doing some good. And so therefore, we've seen it make a difference in real people's lives. And so we can become emotionally attached. We want to do whatever it is for more people, even if it's not the optimal thing to do, even if there's a potential to do something more. It's easy to get stuck in that because we've seen it do some good and we just want to get it out because there's a real need.
Right.
But there's also, I think because of the dynamics of the social sector, we're constantly promoting our solutions. This is what you see on people's websites. It's what we're pitching to funders saying this is the best thing that you could possibly fund. It's something that we identify with. It becomes part of our organizational identity. And so it's very hard to let go of any particular solution you have. And what's interesting to me, you know, I've talked to and work with a lot of different nonprofits, is that, you know, I can talk to 10 different nonprofits in the same sector, and they'll all tell me that their solution is the best possible solution out there. And I can't imagine that that's true. They can't all possibly be right.
Yeah.
And yet everyone has that deeply felt belief. And so I think it's important for us to have the data and look at the data to see what really is the best solution. And if our solution isn't the best, recognize that and look at how we can improve it, or look at how we can adopt somebody else's solution or elements of someone else's solution, or partner with someone else. And you know, that kind of rigor behind delivering the most impact we can will get us a lot further.
You're a computer scientist, so you're, of course, that's why you're on something stronger than encouraging. You're insisting that we be data-driven. You're a scientist, and so you're bringing the rigor of the scientific method to this social change work. We'll get to, you know, it's just that it's tempting to talk about it now. A third of your book is how to make this change in your organization, culturally. But I have to talk about it now too, because we're talking about ego. This is difficult for people to abandon ego, put aside ego, and recognize that their solution isn't the best, that the work that they've been devoted to isn't the best way to solve the problem that they're attacking. Ego is ego's a tough thing to fiddle with, to get people to put aside.
Yeah, it is.
And organizations, and an organization to put aside.
Yeah, I mean, both individually and as organizations, again, because we're doing good, our tendency is to want to encourage each other, pat each other on the back, you know, encourage each other. You're doing good. Keep going. Keep doing this. You know, you're taking a lower salary. You're working long hours. Like, who wants to discourage people who are doing that? And one of the things that I loved about coming into the social sector is, you know, just the culture. You know, people are so encouraging, so embracing, so supportive of each other. And yet I think something is also lost in that we, because we want to encourage each other, we often are reluctant to ask each other the hard questions of, you know, is this working as well as it could? Could we do more? Kind of point out ways that maybe something is not quite meeting its full potential.
And when I said you're a computer scientist, I didn't mean to minimize it's 2 decades almost of work that you've been in nonprofits as well. I don't know what the balance is, but you've done quite a bit of work in the nonprofit community too. I didn't mean to say that you're fresh to the nonprofits. That's not the case at all. All right. So yeah, you want us to think big with these audacious goals that are properly bounded. Think big, but start small. Flesh that out.
Yeah, so once you have that audacious goal, there's a temptation to say, I have a solution that's good enough, let's just execute and deliver as much of it as we can. But when we start small, it allows us to run experiments much more quickly and cheaply. If you're working with 5 or 10 or 50 people, you can be much more nimble. You can, you know, try things out. You can learn much more quickly. You can adapt and change much more quickly than if you're working with thousands of people. And so by starting small, it allows us to accelerate that pace of learning, again, where we don't have a solution that we know is good enough to fully solve the problems that we're trying to address.
Okay, now this is, quite contrary to what's traditional and typical and quite a bit less efficient than what you're promoting. Help people understand, like you mentioned these experiments. So what are these experiments going to look like with 10 people or 50 people instead of 5,000 people?
Yeah, sure. Let me give an example maybe from a social enterprise in Kenya. So there's a social enterprise called Copia Global in Kenya that decided to focus on the issue that people who are low income living in remote rural areas have a very limited choice of consumer goods. They can only really get the staples. And so they have a lot less choice of things that can enrich their lives. And so they set out to address this problem to give people a much wider choice by sort of being the Amazon, if you will, of rural Kenya. And, you know, what some organizations might do is to go out, you know, build some warehouses, build transportation infrastructure, build some catalog ordering system, hire a bunch of staff and so forth, and roll out an offering. And that would take a lot of time and effort and money to do so. Instead, they decided to run an experiment, a minimum viable product or MVP, which are these small experiments that Eric talks about in the Lean Startup that allow us to validate our assumptions first. And so in the case of Copia Global, their assumptions that they wanted to test were, first, would people order from a catalog? Was this something people would find appealing? Second, what kinds of products would they be most interested in? And third, would agents sell from the catalog? Could they find agents that would help them sell in these different areas? And so what they did in their MVP was that the CEO at the time, Crispin, went to the sort of Walmart equivalent in the city and took photos of a bunch of different products, pasted them into a handful of catalogs, and gave them out to potential agents in a few villages, and sat back to see what would happen. And now when somebody came in and they wanted to place an order, the agent would give him a call. He would literally himself go run to the store, pick up that product just at the retail store, buy it, carry it to the village, and deliver it. And certainly this was not something that was scalable at all. But it's something that they could get up and running in the course of a few days or a week and start to learn. And what did they learn? One, they learned that people were ordering from these catalogs. It was appealing. People did have a demand for these products that were too hard for them to get. And so they validated demand. Second, they learned what products people were most interested in. That helped them figure out what things to put in their catalog when they actually ramped up the business, what things to stock in the warehouse, and so forth. And third, they had a surprise. The people they thought would be the best agents, who were the kiosk owners or the people who had these kind of corner store equivalents that sold consumer staples, they thought that those would make the best agents, but they turned out to be terrible agents because they were far more interested in moving their own inventory in the store. But what they found out was that what made better agents were the people who ran complementary businesses like a hair salon, where their customers would be sitting around waiting to get their haircut. They could flip through the catalog, order things that they were looking for, and it became an additional revenue stream for the business. And so through this MVP, they were able to answer all sorts of questions very quickly, very cheaply, that helped them steer the next stage of their business in a far more effective direction. And so it's experiments like these and that help us learn more quickly rather than focusing just on how do we roll out our program or our solution.
And the MVP, the minimum viable product, that's at the root of all this. It's smart because it you will avoid risk. You're avoiding spending a lot of money and a lot of time on a solution that isn't the best, maybe based on assumptions that are invalid, and then is gonna end up doing a disservice to the people you're trying to serve, to your employees, to your funders. Flesh out more of this and how nonprofits could apply the minimum viable product to their work. Think through how to do that.
Yeah, so the minimum viable product is really an experiment that tests that hypothesis. So just to step back a little bit, when we think small, so when we have a solution and we, there's some risks behind whether it will work or not, there's some unknowns, the first step is to identify those unknowns so we can test them. And in the realm of social innovation, I think there's three pillars of what makes a successful social innovation, and that is that it has to deliver value, impact, and growth. So value is this something people want? Not only want, but will demand, will come back for, will tell their friends about? Does it fill a deeply felt need, both by your beneficiary, as well as by other stakeholders who need to buy in? Because if people don't want what you have to offer, you're going to be swimming upstream the whole time. The second, once you have, ascertained this is something people want, you have to ask, does it have impact? Does this make a difference? Does it deliver the social benefit you're looking for? In other words, does it work? And I think too often we get far along in delivering something that people want and that sounds good to us, but doesn't necessarily deliver the social impact. And then the third pillar is growth. Even if we're delivering social impact through a few people, usually the scope of a problem is huge. There may be millions or hundreds of millions of people who have a particular need. And so how do we create an engine that will accelerate growth over time so that we can reach people, enough people, to really move the needle? And so the MVP is really the first step in what Eric calls the build, measure, learn feedback loop, which is essentially applying the scientific method to the risks that we identify in each of these three categories, that you identify a potential risk, for example, that people may not want to order from the catalog. You build an MVP like Copia did to test that assumption. Then you measure the results. You gather data to see how many people order, did people engage. And then finally, you learn. If you're successful, then maybe it's safe to double down. If you're not successful, like, for example, with Copia, they found out that the agents in these corner stores were not selling from the catalog, then yes, they had to tweak their solution to look for other agents that might be more effective. And sometimes you find that, you're completely off base and you need to pivot and take a different direction altogether. And so it's driving that build, measure, learn feedback loop as quickly as possible that drives social innovation. And, we all do this in the full course of time, except that often the build, measure, learn feedback loop can take years. By the time we deploy a program, measure it, evaluate, and then learn from it, it can take years. And so what Lean Impact does is really ask, how do we move that learning cycle from an order of years to an order of days or weeks?
Yeah, yeah. All right, we got to take another break. When we come back, Anne May and I, she's going to tell some more stories about a public school system, for instance, as great examples of this constant testing and learning and iterating. And we're talking about Wegner, CPAs. If you need help with your 990, do you? I hope you're getting it out very soon. Are your books properly managed? Have you got the books? Do you know how you're doing financially? If you've got a CPA, maybe you're thinking about a change in 2019. Talk to the Wegner, the partner there, Yeet Uchtoom. You know him. He's been a guest. You know him. You start out at WegnerCPAs.com and then pick up the phone. Talk to Yeet. Check out WegnerCPAs.com. Now, time for Tony's Take Two. Training. Trains. I encourage you to invest in basic planned giving training for your fundraising team. And I recognize your fundraising team might be just you or you and the CEO. But get the basics of planned giving down. You want them to be you and your team. You want to be comfortable opening the door to conversations about estate planned gifts. This is not expertise. This is opening doors to conversations. You're not talking about death, like a lot of fundraisers think, that's a complete misconception. You're talking about the long-term value of your work and what a long-term gift is going to mean to keeping that work going beyond all of us. So that's the essence of basic planned giving training. And in my video, I put a little holiday spin on training. So you check that out at TonyMartinetti.com. Let's go back to Anne May Chang and Lean Impact. So Anne May, you have this example of Summit Public Schools. I felt like they were a good example of this iterating and testing, learning, and iterating.
Yeah, one of the reasons that I think people struggle to look at how you can apply these tools in the social sector is that impact can take a long time to measure. And take a long time to fully realize. And so, the example of Summit Public Schools is a great one because they work in education, where educational attainment is one of those things that can take a long time to fully realize. And the founder of Summit Public Schools, a woman named Diane Tavener, started out with this audacious goal that she wanted to start some schools that would serve a diverse student population where 100% of them would graduate from college. Now, they brought in the best practices that they could find in education, started up a couple charter schools, and 8 years later, when their first cohort graduated from college, they were highly successful. They beat out most of their peers. And people were recognizing for this and encouraging her to scale her solution. But what Diane recognized was that even though that they were doing well, they were doing better than many others, she believed they could do better. And she she had set out this goal of getting 100% of the students to graduate, and they weren't there yet. And so she decided to invest instead in trying to figure out how to improve on the model. But she realized she didn't want to wait another 8 years for the next cohort to graduate. Yeah. That would be way too long in order to see whether she was improving the models enough. So instead, she decided to focus on building in a culture of learning, of iteration, of innovation into their organization. And so what this looked like was they started out by running week-long experiments and did so over the course of 57 weeks. And each week they would vary the structure of their classroom, the content of the classroom, the types of activities, whether it be kind of traditional lectures by teachers or self-paced learning on computers or small group projects or one-on-one tutoring. And they would look at all these different ways, tools that they had, and measure it each week by running student assessments, doing focus groups to see what things students are most engaged with, interviewing teachers. And so each week they would gather this data, learn what worked and didn't work about what they had tried that week, and adapt what they're doing, and then try something slightly different the next week. And so over the course of this year, they essentially refined their model, a very transformative model for personalized learning, and have been highly successful. Their most recent cohort, 99% got admitted to college. They haven't yet graduated from college. But now this model that they've developed has been adopted by over 300 public schools around the country. So it shows that when you take a little bit more time up front to invest in improving what you're doing, to really maximizing the quality of what you're able to deliver, then it'll pay dividends over time. And even in the case of education, where fully measuring educational attainment may take years, and eventually they'll get to looking at their graduation rates from college, there are often earlier indicators that can help you determine whether you're on track or not and help you improve your solution along the way.
And as you're improving, there's a very good chance you may need to pivot based on what you're learning. I thought the VisionSpring case in the book was a good example of multiple pivots. Can you talk about that one?
Yeah, so a lot of times when we think about innovation, we think about the big, flashy new ideas. And VisionSpring decided to focus on a 700-year-old invention that has been proven to increase productivity and improve learning potential, and that's eyeglasses. And so despite being 700 years old, there's an estimated 2.5 billion people who need eyeglasses and don't have them. And so VisionSpring sought to bridge this gap. As we talked about earlier, they set out with an audacious goal that there's 2.5 billion people in need. And they started out as most nonprofits would by piloting in two locations, in their case, El Salvador and India. They recruited people they called vision entrepreneurs to go out to rural areas, do vision exams, and provide eyeglasses, and came back with really moving stories of people who weren't able to work, being able to work again, kids who weren't able to learn, being able to learn more effectively. And many nonprofits would be thrilled by that. We're making a big difference. But it wasn't enough for VisionSpring. They recognized they were losing money with each person they reached, and they would never be able to scale to the degree that they needed to achieve their goal. So they pivoted. Their second incarnation is that they set up vision centers in more urban areas that would serve a more affluent population and took the profits from that to cross-subsidize outreach into more rural areas. And through this mechanism, they were able to become financially self-sustainable. Also something that most nonprofits would think, this is a huge success. Not only are we doing good, we're doing it in a financially self-sustainable way. But VisionSpring thought, again, it wasn't enough because it would take them decades to be able to scale their infrastructure to get to all the people around the world who could benefit. So they pivoted again. They partnered with an organization in Bangladesh called BRAC, which has community healthcare workers in every corner of the country and used their existing network to provide vision care. And through their partnership with BRAC, they've reached over 1 million people to date. And through other partnerships, they've now reached over 4.5 million people. Well, that's a pretty impressive number for a nonprofit, 4.5 million people. But it still wasn't enough for VisionSpring because 4.5 million is only a tiny fraction of 2.5 billion. And they recognized that the problem here was really a systems problem, that any one organization could never reach all of these people, that we needed to figure out how to make markets work and how to make governments work better. And so they decided to set up a public-private partnership called the Eyliance that brought together eyeglass manufacturers, nonprofits, and local governments to look at how they could work together to change the system, to encourage eyeglass manufacturers to manufacture lower-cost eyeglasses and distribute them to more remote areas, and to encourage governments to provide eye care to their citizens. And one of their early successes was with the government of Liberia. They signed a MOU where the government of Liberia agreed to work with them to provide vision care through their national healthcare network, as well as their public school system. And so you can imagine now, as they're approaching this problem from a more systems approach and working with making governments and businesses work for people to provide vision care to everyone, that they can eventually get to this really audacious goal they set out to. But it required them to be humble enough, again, to your point, to put their ego aside, to recognize when their solution wasn't good enough and to be willing to pivot.
Okay. I like that example. Thank you. All right. We got to take another break. Telos, start with the video at tony.ma/TonyTelos. Then think about this. What companies can you ask that would consider switching their credit card processing to Telos? Maybe it's one owned by a board member. Maybe it's one that's already been supporting you. Talk to them. Have them watch the video. And if they switch, you get that long stream of passive revenue every single month. It's basically unearned, but you've earned it. It's that long stream passive revenue. That's the goal. And that's what you can get through Telos. You'll find this video and the intro at tony.ma/TonyTelos. Now, back to Anne May Chang. Anne May, the tech industry has taken off, well, not just recently, but has been able to grow so rapidly, what you call the hockey stick growth curve. And a lot of that is explained by Moore's Law, I think I know what it is, but you're the computer scientist. You tell us just briefly what Moore's Law is.
Yeah, so Moore's Law was something that was defined by Moore, who was at Intel, I think almost 50 years ago now, that said the number of transistors, essentially that the speed of computer chips would double every 2 years. And it's held true for almost 50 years now. And because of this, it's driven this exponential growth in the computing industry, where a computer that used to take up a whole building now fits in your pocket. And you can imagine all the things that that's enabled us to do. And so, you know, it's the underlying driver, a lot of the progress we see in the tech industry.
So my question to you is, what is May's Law going to be? There's got to be, we need a May's Law for the social change sector.
Well, I think that, you know, Moore's Law certainly has driven the speed of the advancement in the speed of computers. But what's behind it in terms of, like, how does that actually happen? You don't just sit back and have Moore's Law take place. Part of how that's happened is because Silicon Valley is so competitive, because there are so many opportunities that people have really refined a way to accelerate progress and accelerate innovation. And that's what I think the lean startup captured so well. And it really is about having those audacious goals, you know, like how do, you know, doubling every 2 years is a really fast pace of progress. And it requires organizations to take risks, to try different techniques, to try different approaches, and to figure out how to learn as quickly as possible. And that's, you know, where some of these innovation techniques have really been honed. But I do think that these techniques are just as important and just as needed for the social sector, because we're talking about solving, you know, real challenges that people are suffering, where there's real needs. And so we need it more than ever. And I truly believe that these same techniques are equally applicable in the social sector. I've seen organizations be successful in applying them and be able to dramatically magnify their impact. I think there is a real translation there. But again, it's not easy. It's much harder in the social sector. And so, the Lean Impact book is really my attempt at looking at how do we adapt these tools for the realities of social good.
Okay. Well, I hope you believe in all this, because that's what the book is about. So you said, said you believe these tools apply. I hope you do. All right. But I'm challenging you. I want to see a May's Law. And May's Law, if you want. But I like the alliteration of going from Moore's to May's. I'm concerned. I guess I'm not really asking you, I'm telling you what about my concern. I'm concerned about what I call legacy nonprofits. Maybe I didn't catch if you use that in the book, but you know, the ones that are so big and bureaucratic, that taking on new thinking like this and vast culture change, just doesn't seem likely. I mean, they just seem like dinosaurs that don't know what their future is, don't know how bleak their future is. I don't know. Are you more optimistic than I am about those types of legacy institutions?
I am. I mean, maybe it's in part because in my last job at USAID, I worked at one of those dinosaur institutions, you know, on the funder side here, but we also worked with a lot of large established nonprofits that have been around for ages. You know, the USAID is the U.S. government's foreign aid agency. We're one of the largest donors in the world, and we're government. So, you know, we are a large, entrenched, bureaucratic organization. And even at USAID, we, you know, with the vision of Raj Shah, who was administrator when I joined USAID, he set up something called the Global Development Lab that was recognizing that, you know, the world is changing and we need to change with it if we want to stay relevant. And so the lab was set up with this dual part mission to identify innovations that could dramatically move the needle on our aim to fight global poverty, as well as to look at how we could transform the development, the tools and our approach to development itself to accelerate both our own work and those of our partners. And so I saw through that how we could, in a large established bureaucratic organization, start planting the seeds of a new culture. It's not easy. In our case, it was a separate team that kind of started out that was protected by the leadership, but that ultimately over time made inroads across the whole agency by finding other people who really, you know, saw the need, you know, felt compelled to find better tools, yeah, and were interested in partnering with us. And I've seen this happen at lots of large nonprofits as well, that they, you know, that they recognize that, you know, people work at nonprofits because they care about the mission. And even though some parts of organizations may be entrenched, there's always some people there who, you know, are restless and want to find better solutions and are just looking for the tools and opportunity to use them.
Yeah. All right. Well, that we capitalize on that restlessness because, you know, doing well isn't as good as doing the best. And that's what, you know, that's running through the book. That's your thesis. You know, we want to do it to maximum scale. You know, as you say, greatest social benefit, the largest possible scale. All right, so let's move over to making this this transformation. You know, what you call a re-architecture of organizations. You say that, you know, we're relying on 19th century institutions using 20th century tools to address 21st century problems. And we need to, the third part of your book is about the re-architecture of not only the institutions that are doing the work, but also the funding institutions and the funding models. Why don't you, you lead us into this one. How would you like to start this conversation about making this transformation?
Yeah, so one of the biggest challenges that I heard over and over again across the over 200 organizations I interviewed was funding, that funding becomes an incredible impediment. One of the biggest issues with funding is that funding tends to be highly restrictive. Most funders want to see you deliver very concrete short-term deliverables. That's how they measure you by. And in your proposal, they expect you to lay out in excruciating detail exactly how you're going to do that, how you're going to spend every penny, every person you're going to hire, and you know, put together essentially what I call a grand master plan, and then execute on that plan, sometimes over as many as 5 years. And those plans are quite rigid, and it prevents us from experimenting, prevents us from taking risks, prevents us from pivoting and taking a different path. One of the saddest types of stories I heard over and over again were from organizations who would get a grant from a foundation, start executing on that grant, realize that it wasn't working, but then continue doing it anyway. And of course, no one wants to go on the record about this, but I can tell you there's lots of organizations that do this.
Yeah.
But it's just too hard to go back to your funder and say, this isn't working. You're worried you're going to lose the grant altogether then. And so finding a different way, this kind of existing relationship is one that seems like micromanagement to me. And we all know that people don't do their best work when they're micromanaged. So I think the first thing we need to do is re-architect the relationship between funders and nonprofits, that we need to have a relationship that's a little bit more based on trust, that allows for more risk, that allows for more agility. And there's a number of tools that we've tried to do this at the Global Development Lab at USAID. One of those is to tier funding. We have a mechanism called Development Innovation Ventures that was modeled after venture capital, where rather than giving out the big monolithic grants that USAID typically does, we would give out much smaller grants that we could take much more risk with and allow people to experiment if they could show us that they had an idea where they thought they could develop a far more cost-effective solution than what was out there.
Yes.
And so we give out these grants that were like typically about $100,000 for them to try these things out. And if they were successful, if they were able to get data back that showed that this thing had traction, then we give them a larger grant of $1 million and then $5 million. And so just like in the startup world where venture capitalists come in and they give you small amounts of money to test out your ideas and more money as you get more traction, by funding this way in the nonprofit space, we can allow people to take a lot more risks. We can allow funders to try a lot more different potential solutions, but without putting too much at stake, you know, because you don't, what you want to do, if you're going to innovate, you need to fail. But what you want to do is fail small, not fail big.
Yes. All right. Well, we got to take a break. And when we come back, Anne May and I are going to continue this about making the change and talk some about within your own organization now, incentivizing and hiring. Text to Give. They have a 5-part email mini course, which is debunking 5 myths. Do you think that all text donations are small, the capped at like $5 or $10 or $15? Not true. Do you think there's a monthly or annual minimum? No, there doesn't need to be. There's a good amount of misinformation around text giving, and you can break through that with this 5-part email mini course, end up raising more money. You get the email mini course, you text NPR to 444-999. And now we've got several more minutes for Lean Impact. So Anne May, anything, just is there one more thing you want to share with us about lessons at USAID before we turn it to the nonprofits doing the work and some of the incentivizing there? One more thing you want to share with at USAID?
I think we were just talking about tiered funding. Another mechanism that can be really effective is paying for outcomes. You know, looking at how do we incentivize outcomes rather than incentivize activities, because outcomes is ultimately what matters. You know, Eric in his book talks about something he calls vanity metrics these absolute numbers that we all use to say we've reached or touched or helped, you know, 1 million people. And, you know, this is plastered all over nonprofit and foundation websites in terms of trying to give people some sense of what they've done. But those numbers are meaningless because it just says, like, we've done stuff or we were good at raising money. It doesn't say whether we made a big difference in those people's lives.
Yeah.
And it doesn't say whether another organization with the same resources could have done even more. And so what Eric encourages us to do and what Lean Impact talks about is moving away from these vanity metrics to actionable or innovation metrics that are at the unit level that look at what is our conversion rate, our unit costs, our success rate, because when we can optimize for those types of those unit level metrics, those are the things that are going to make a big difference over time.
All right. And this creates thoughts for and fodder for conversation with your funders, potential funders, and also, of course, for foundations themselves to try to rethink. I mean, maybe, you know, experiment yourselves. For our foundation listeners, with an organization or two, in some of these some of these different funding methods. Obviously, more detail in the book. You got to get the book. Let's turn to the 501c3s themselves, and you talk a good bit about incentivizing around this around Lean Impact and the iteration and the testing and the learning. Talk some about incentivizing.
Sure. What I see is because innovation is hard in the social sector, I do see a lot of nonprofits these days talking about innovation and wanting to innovate. And usually what ends up happening is that innovation is something that gets bolted on rather than built in. And by bolted on, I mean, you know, organizations tend to, you know, either run a contest or a hackathon or a pilot, or they, you know, hire like an innovation person or a small innovation team. And these things are usually off to the side. They're not part of the core operations of a nonprofit, but something that they can kind of highlight and issue nice press releases about, but go on business as usual with 99% of what they're doing. And so if you really want to, and so what the result is that we see all these kind of pilots and all these contests and flashy ideas, but very few of them making an appreciable difference over time. So if what we care about is getting to impact and transforming the culture and building a culture of innovation, we need to do that from the ground up. And I think that starts by establishing, an audacious goal, something that, that we is measurable, that we continue to reference back to, that we, reinforce, that is the North Star for everyone in the organization to measure their own work against. Like Vision Spring, to be able to ask the question, is this going to get us to 2.5 billion people? And so you need to start out with that goal, because again, if you have a goal that is achievable with business as usual, there's no reason for anyone to do anything different.
Right.
And then secondly, we need to create incentives that reinforce that goal, both reinforce the importance of taking risks and celebrate failure, as well as reinforce progress towards that goal, on those innovation metrics. So if you're able to reduce your costs, increase your success rate, and so forth, those are the metrics that really matter in getting to the goal. And so finding mechanisms that incentivize. And incentives could be, financial incentives, but they don't have to be. They can be just, what does leadership highlight when you have an organization, all hands meeting? What do you highlight in your press releases? What are the, who gets recognized? What are the things that you talk about in your weekly updates? So those incentives are incredibly important because they are what culture forms around. And then finally, once you have those goals and those incentives, then you can look at where do you need to fill the gaps in terms of talent? Do you need to bring in some other people who bring in a different skill set than you might have? Do you need to train your existing staff in some of these innovation techniques? That's sort of the last step. And too often people make that the first and only step and don't get a lot of traction.
We got to leave it there. Another book you need. There's so much more there. You can follow Ann May. She's at Ann May. That's A-N-N-M-E-I. We're not talking about Ellie May from the Beverly Hillbillies. This is Ann May. So it's not M-A-Y. It's M-E-I. And you'll find her book at annmay.com. Ann May, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Pleasure. Next week, consultant Sarah Olivieri with admonition, but also, of course, encouragement for small and mid-sized nonprofits. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled, tony.ma/Pursuant. We're by Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. By Telos, credit, card, and payment processing, your passive revenue stream, tony.ma/TonyTelos. And by Text to Give, mobile donations made easy, text NPR to 444-999. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Liebowitz is the line producer, but today it's by Chris. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy, and this music is by Scott Stein of Brooklyn, New York. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network. Are you stuck in a rut? Negative thoughts, feelings, and conversations got you down? Hi, I'm Noreen Sumter, the Potentiator. Tune in every Tuesday at 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time and listen for new ideas on my show, Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way, on talkradio.nyc.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com. Talking Alternative.
Do you like comic books and movies? How about TV and pop culture? Then you've come to the right place. Hi, I'm Michael Dolce, host of Secrets of the Sire. Joined every week by my co-host, Hassan, Lord of the Radio Godwin. Together, we have over 15 years' experience creating graphic novels, screenplays, and more. Join us as we bring you the inside scoop on the pop culture universe you love to talk about. Wednesday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern, talkradio.nyc.
Did you know you've been playing poker your whole life, even if you've never played a hand of cards? Hi, I'm Ellen Lakend, author of Poker Woman and host of the new show, Poker Divas. On the show, I talk about how poker strategy helps you win in business, life, and love. Tune in live every Thursday, 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.